Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And as I mentioned just a minute ago, I'm going to talk a little bit about something called the Jatropha Stove Project. It's something that aims to promote plant-based biofuels for use in a sustainable stove design in Haiti and other deforested areas of the world. And we're going to visit with three people about it today. John Greenler back again. And John is the Director of Outreach and Education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, or the GLBRC, as we like to. That's what you like to use, isn't it, John?
It's a bit of a mouthful. Thank you.
It's a bit of a mouthful, but there it is. Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Our other two guests, Eileen Chow and Tyler Lark, are members of a team of engineering graduates and undergraduates at the UW-Madison who are working on this Jatropha stove project. It won an award in the 2010 Climate Leadership Challenge, and so I thought it'd be a lot of fun and very interesting to talk about this project and talk about future generation biofuels as well as we get along here, as we move along. You can join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. John, great to have you back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Eileen, thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having us.
And you're an engineering student?
I just graduated in May with a mechanical engineering degree, and now I'm working for a nonprofit in Haiti.
Excellent. And Tyler Lark, our other guest today. Tyler, thank you for coming by, and what's your history?
So this is my final year of a undergraduate major at UW, so finishing up in engineering as well.
All right. Well, I tell you what. Your microphone was running a little low here, but we'll see what we can do about it. I had the volume up as loud as it'll go, so we'll see what happens. You guys might have to share a microphone, you and Tyler, you and Eileen, as we move along here today. But let's talk about that project. It's a two-part project, as I understand, Eileen.
Yeah, so basically there are two main goals here. First of all, reforestation. We got involved with the idea by being involved with Engineers Without Borders through the Haiti program at UW-Madison. And so there's three of us on the team, and all three of us had traveled to the community before. And immediately you can see, like, all of Haiti, it's very deforested. So the problem with that is that people use wood charcoal as a main cooking fuel in Haiti. So people are basically cutting down trees to cook their food. So the two main goals are reforestation and introducing another type of cooking fuel and stove.
Yeah, and that other type of cooking fuel is what, Tyler?
Right, so it's based off of...
So it's this really great bush known as Jatropha. It grows in the tropics, and it grows to be about the size of a person. And what this bush does is it produces an oil-bearing nut or seed, and this seed can be ground up or pressed to get an oil very similar to your traditional vegetable oil, so canola oil or peanut oil, soybean oil, and then that oil can then be used directly as a cooking fuel. And so how we do that is with this little stove that we designed that's completely constructible from locally available waste materials and really available to all kinds of people across the world. So
that's pretty cool, John.
Yeah, I think it's really an exceptional story of ingenuity and appropriate technology to meet a particular need.
And describe this. It looks to me, we have one here. Maybe I can shoot a picture on my iPhone and put it up on our Facebook page during the show at some point. The base looks like a coconut almost to me.
Yep, that's exactly what it is. It's just a hollowed out coconut, and then that coconut shell can then hold the oil. So it's the oil canister container. And then to burn the oil, we actually just use really old-fashioned technology, just like an oil-burning lamp that was around centuries ago. And you can even construct the wicks for this oil-burning stove from locally available materials like the fibers from a mango. So completely buildable from local agricultural waste products that are typically just laying around or thrown away anyways.
Oh, man. So how did you come up with the idea and design for the stove, Eileen?
It took several iterations. So it started out with Jason Lohr, our third teammate, coming to us and talking about the need for a solution for this. And then it was kind of hours and hours of toying with some ideas, looking at some materials. Somebody bought a coconut at some point. And just kind of Saturdays messing around with different materials, different ideas, and trying things out.
And now it'll work as a stove. Now I'm seeing several wicks on this. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really meant to be just a standard replacement that can be used as is with the current cooking methods in Haiti and across the world. So instead of using a pile of charcoal or wood piled up there, you can just use this little coconut filled with oil and light the wicks, and you'll get these nice little consistent flames. And you can vary the temperature and heat by having a different number of wicks. And you just slide it in underneath your pan and cook away. It's great. We've used it for cooking out, camping, and all sorts of things. So it's really
so you've
really
tried
simple.
It out in the field.
Oh yeah.
Well, John, this is a fantastic idea, isn't it?
I think it really demonstrates that when we look globally at what our needs are, I think there's lots of different materials, biological materials that we can use to address energy and environmental issues that also kind of address different types of technology needs. Clearly here in the States in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, we're very focused on our need to look at alternatives in terms of liquid transportation fuels. How can we use sustainable materials, cellulosic materials, to make replacements for gasoline and diesel? But when we travel to Haiti and we consider what their needs are, they're very, very different in terms of their needs and also in terms of, what kind of materials they have at hand to solve their problems. So it's really looking at the context of what the need is and what's available.
This is part of the Climate Leadership Challenge. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So that was last spring, and we actually proposed this idea through another competition as well. The university also hosts Innovation Days, which is an invention competition. It's on the College of Engineering campus, open to any undergraduate student. So we use this in both competitions.
And so this challenge, this Climate Leadership Challenge, then is just designed to really bring out great ideas. Then.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. This is a really great campus-wide competition founded by some very generous donors that really just wanted to motivate and provide a framework for innovation for students and everybody who has ideas that can help solve the climate challenge. So whether it's prevention, mitigation, or adaptation, the Climate Leadership Challenge was just really good at providing the framework and spark and fire for all these innovative ideas to come out. So we had the final presentation was at the Earth Day Conference last May, and it was just a really great event, lots of great ideas, lots of great people out there, and just a good atmosphere all around.
I want to give people a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment as we move along here today, give us a call. The number 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Let's talk about that Jatropha plant a little bit more. What has it been used for? Was it just a weed or what?
Yep. So it grows naturally. It's found originally in the Caribbean. It's native to Haiti and other areas like that. And really recently, in the past 5-10 years, it's spread to the entire tropics. So countries such as India and Malaysia have really gone and pushed it as a biofuel for traditional biofuels. So they'll plant it and then use the oil and refine that into a biodiesel for your traditional biofuel applications. So in that sense, it's been around for a while. But what we kind of thought was interesting and useful for a lot of really poor developing countries is a direct immediate application of the oil where you don't have to go through this sort of extra processing to biodiesel. It's just a very nice local application that's simplified and provides one of the most basic needs of a cooking fuel. So,
well, let's take some calls. Larry in Park Falls up first here. Larry, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. Hey, I was wondering, how much oil do you get out of a nut and how much energy is expended in cracking them, mashing them, gathering them, yep. And what they're using to do that and to store,
yeah,
or to extract, I should say, the oil out of there.
Yeah, so are we using more energy to get the oil out than there is in the oil that we have? That's a decent question.
You know, that's a great question. So with Jatropha, the seed typically yields about 30 to 40% oil. And how it's extracted right now is just very low tech. So you can mash it up in a grinder. There's some big hand manual presses. So this is all being done typically by local manual labor and people that are just doing it on a small scale. So in that sense, it's energy non-intensive, and it's all done at a local scale. There's no transportation to a central processing area or anything like that, and it's just done right at the local level. You can extract the oil by hand through mechanical presses, and it's good to go.
Now, what's the seed look like anyway? Is it the size of a marble or what? Oh, you've got some here.
We have some here. I would say it's about the size of half a marble. Typically, they're 1 centimeter by 2 centimeters or so. And really, what's really neat is that once you press the seed, the press cake that's left over that isn't used for the oil, that can be used further for fertilizer and things of that nature as well.
Oh, cool.
One of the things, just getting back to the nature of the plant, that I think is really significant is that it's a perennial. So you plant this, you know, seed once, and really I think the expectation is that your Jatropha plant should be able to live for 50 years or more. And that really, you know, provides a lot of opportunities. A, you don't have to be constantly using a lot of energy to replant your crop each year. But then from a kind of an ecological, environmental perspective, it really holds a lot of soil and it retains a lot of nutrients. It's much lower inputs. It's very efficient in terms of water use. And so once again, getting back to that energy question, kind of doing that life cycle analysis of how much you need to put in versus out, these perennial plants are really big winners. In some ways, if you think about biofuels more locally, it has some parallels in that aspect to using switchgrass, for example, here in southern Wisconsin.
Talking about the Jatropha Stove Project, and we'll also get into some future generation biofuel discussions as well with our three guests, John Greenler, Tyler Lark, and Eileen Chow. They'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, three guests today talking with us. We're taking a look at biofuels, and we're talking about the Jatropha Stove Project with John Greenler, Director of Outreach and Education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Tyler Lark and Eileen Chow are members of a team of engineering and graduates and undergraduates at UW-Madison working on this Jatropha Stove Project, and it aims to promote plant-based biofuels for use in a sustainable stove design in Haiti and other deforested areas of the world. It's a kind of a two-part project, combines the use of oil from the Jatropha plant with this award-winning invention that I have in front of me, which is part of a coconut, and it's sort of some pieces, metal pieces that you might find almost anywhere. So it's a stove that can be made right on site in places like Haiti, and it's finding some good use. And it really, what it's meant to sort of accomplish in one way is to the deforestation that has taken place in countries like Haiti, where people have had to use wood for their cooking. Now with this Jatropha plant, they can use it instead, and we can reforest countries like Haiti that have undergone deforestation and provide a fuel and a very inexpensive, essentially about free practically, stove for them to use. And before we go back to the phones, and Dave in New Holstein's up, and Marshall in Stoughton has a question for you, but the plans on this, now you've worked on this. Now, Tyler Lark, what are you going to do with it? You're following up on this, I'm sure.
Absolutely. So
in Haiti, we're actually moving forward with a pilot project. So through Engineers Without Borders, we have this great relationship with a rural community in the northern part of Haiti and partnering with some agronomists and local farmers there to implement just a small pilot program. So planting some Jatropha for soil remediation, and then down the line, once it starts producing some of these seeds and oil, you can use that as a replacement cooking fuel. And that's great. And then right back here on the UW-Madison campus, we also have activities going on A group of students are really getting underway in with doing research regarding this fuel. So we just opened up a space on the Walnut Street greenhouse. Mm-hmm. So we've got a nice little plot. Next weekend, we're going to plant about 100 Jatropha seedlings there and get started with some research to try to develop some best practices and get some familiarity with the cultivation of this crop. So it's really great.
Great. Eileen, how long does it take for a plant to get up to the point where it's producing seeds, you know, or maybe?
It depends on the soil that you have it in, but sometimes up within a year you can have oil-bearing fruit develop.
So that's pretty fast compared to a tree.
Exactly.
A lot faster. Dave in New Holstein, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Oh, hello. I just wanted to say that it sounds like such a great idea. The problem is, I can see is that Haiti and Central America, South America are pretty much in line for hurricanes. And when a hurricane goes through, it may take care of your crop. And you may go a period of time without the ability to have oil to run it. And I guess what I'm calling about is solar ovens. And solar ovens have been proven to really help, especially in places where trees or wood or anything isn't available. And using these in conjunction with yours would really help. And I'd also like to say that around the country they have big metal shows, lots of equipment. Fabtechs, they call them, down at the McCormick place in Chicago and things. And all these machines, thousands of machines, are showing off their machines by cutting parts out of metal. And at the end of the day, end of the show, they throw this metal out or it's scrapped. And they could be cutting these solar ovens to use in conjunction with yours. Solar ovens don't work when there isn't sun. That's where yours would really come in. And I think, but solar ovens require zero, just the sun, to work.
Yeah.
Right. So the two working combined, to me, would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Elaine?
I think what you're suggesting is there's no one solution, so which is totally right. The thing about our stove versus the solar oven is that solar ovens are kind of a whole new practice. People aren't used to using solar ovens when they're used to cooking over charcoal. But you're right that all of these solutions should be looked at and should be investigated, and no one can take over any the best.
Yeah,
solution.
There's not going to be just one solution here, Tyler.
Right. Yeah, I'd absolutely agree. And as far as the hurricane kind of thing goes, so one of the great things about Jatropha is it's really a deep rooting plant. And as John was mentioning before, it's a perennial bush, so it's not just a little crop that might get washed out. So if you plant it at the good time of year in line with the rainy season or dry season, and you get a good, it takes hold, it'll really last through, these storms and weather the hurricanes and that sort of stuff. So that's kind of the goal, is that in addition to weathering through that, it'll also help mitigate and prevent a lot of the negative effects of these things. So soil erosion prevention and soil remediation, and help prevent things like flash flooding as a result of these hurricanes and strong mm-hmm. storms. So.
Yeah. John, you were going to add something there?
Oh. Nope. That's right on track.
Right on track. Thanks again, Dave, for calling. Marshall in Stoughton, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Marshall.
Hi. I know how much oil the world uses per day because that's easy to find, and I can figure out how much equivalent biomass in terms of energy is needed if I can have some rough idea of per volume or per mass. How do oil and biomass compare? I understand you can't give me an exact number, but even a number within a factor of 10 would be adequate.
All right. Well, let's see. Tyler, you want to take a shot at that?
Sure. Well, so the calculations that we've done for our project, you can actually find a bunch of them on our website more if you look there. It's www.cocostove, cocostove.org. But essentially what it came down to looking at energy density and mass, such as you're looking at, is with an acre of land dedicated solely to growing Jatropha and using the oil that results from those plants, you can provide the cooking fuel to feed about 5 families per acre per year. And now comparing that to, say, wood grown directly for the use of as a cooking fuel, that only supplies fuel for about 3 families per acre per year. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's more efficient, and this crop stays on the land throughout. There's no clear cutting of the trees or anything like that. So that's, in that case, it is a little bit, has an advantage versus wood and wood charcoal.
Mm-hmm. All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Marshall. Appreciate it. Paul in Rice Lake, let's turn to you next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering how many plants a typical Haitian family would need to harvest a year if they were going to use this as their sole source of cooking.
Yeah. All right.
So hi, Paul. That goes back to what Tyler just said. So if you think about 1 acre of land would produce enough for 5 families per year. So the thing about this is we're hoping to make it integrated into the community. Obviously, it would be great if everyone could have some Jatropha working not in monoculture but with all their other plants to get together kind of a cooperative to get enough Jatropha oil to work with the community to get enough supply for everyone. But that's in the works in the future, and so that is still being planned.
So 5 families on an acre, so about a fifth of an acre.
Yeah, yep.
Is what one family would need for a year. And actually, it would come back the next year. So pretty much, you know, I would assume that at some point the plants are going to peter out, but it's going to be a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, one of the other great things that should be mentioned about this Jatropha is we're really hoping it has great characteristics and qualities where it doesn't need very high-quality soil, so it can be planted in areas where right now they're not under use or not under till. So eroded mountainsides, hillsides, places like that, and that's really where the best application of this would come in, where you're not competing with your traditional food crops or other cash crops, but where you can plant it in areas where you need soil remediation, let it go, you don't have to tend to it, you don't have to maintain it, and then, you know, a couple years down the line, you can start really benefiting from this additional use of the oil, which is just this extra icing on the cake, you could say.
I'm trying to feature how it looks when it's growing. Is it grown up like a grass area, or is it? Are we rows of? Do we have rows of these plants, or what does that look like, Eileen?
The actual plant looks like a large bush. So as it starts growing, there's actually from my work in Haiti, just kind of walking around where I work, you'll see Jatropha plants growing around. So I would expect that in the future we'll have a nursery and we'll have a space for kind of a pilot plot. But in addition, we want to move away from monoculture because that introduces disease and pests that would want to attack the Jatropha. So basically, right now, people that do biodiesel, they tend to do like rows and rows and rows of these large bushes. But we'll have to work on that with our community to plan it so it's so it's appropriate to what they're working on.
John Greenler, you're going to add something there.
Yeah, I think one analogy that you could maybe evoke, and you guys can elaborate on this, is to think about how coffee is grown. And you hear about Chago coffee as being a very environmentally sustainable and appropriate crop, and so I think Jatropha can really fit into that context as well. So you're getting this renewable harvest every year of the seed, but then you're also providing all these other ecological services as well. So it's holding the soil, it's providing habitat for other insects and birds and whatnot. So you're really providing, as Tyler was elaborating on, there are all these different ways that these plants provide benefits. And really just one of them is the seed that can be used, for making this biofuel.
Excellent. Joe in Platteville has a question or comment. Joe, hello.
Hi. I got a couple questions there. One is I've never really seen studies or statistics or data about the biomass, how it equates. You know, coal is just biomass that's been compressed and over years, and because coal was made from biomass. So now we're talking about burning this biomass. How does that equate per BTU for pollution? In the atmosphere, are we really gaining anything by burning biomass as a whole, not just with your project? And then the second thing I'm concerned with your project there, and that is I farm, and when I take off tons of product per acre, you've got phosphorus and nitrogen and potassium that you take off with any product that's being grown, and so you're taking off tons of product off of an acre. What are you going to replenish that with, or how does that get replenished into the soil so that you don't deplete the soil? So those are two questions there. I got all more right. questions, but I'll leave go with that.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Thanks for calling. John Greener, let's turn to you for part of that.
Yeah, those are some great kind of what I would consider to be mission critical questions for biofuels in general. You know, and you start out, you know, kind of saying, okay, in terms of pollution, how do some of these biofuels compare with, for example, burning fossil fuels, whether that be coal or oil, natural gas, et cetera. And really, it's very important to do what's known as an LCA, a life cycle assessment or analysis, to really kind of look at all of the inputs that are necessary to produce that biofuel and the corresponding energy that you get out. One of the things that's really key, you know, if we're thinking about carbon and greenhouse gas emissions, emissions of CO2, et cetera, is the fact that when you're burning a fossil fuel, that's carbon that's essentially locked up in the ground. It's sequestered and really not causing a problem in terms of global warming. It's not moving into the atmosphere until we burn it as an energy source. And so it's really kind of a one-way pipe of carbon going into the atmosphere, causing a problem, increasing our CO2 levels. Juxtaposing that with a biofuel, the carbon, you're correct, the carbon, when you burn a biofuel, you are releasing carbon in the form of CO2 in the atmosphere. But what's critical is to recognize that carbon came from the atmosphere via photosynthesis. That plant captured energy from the sun, at the same time took CO2 out of the atmosphere to create that carbon-rich biomass material, and then we're just re-releasing it. And so you do need to put some energy in, frequently in the form of fossil fuels, to get that biomass energy. But the vast majority of the time, and it varies from biofuel to biofuel, you know, there is a net gain in terms of a relative decrease in the emission of greenhouse gases.
Well, that's part of this whole Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Project.
We spend a lot of time really tracking the movement of carbon, and we have several fundamental research areas in GLBRC, and our sustainability research area is really the largest of the four that we kind of identify, and we have, you know, very sophisticated instrumentation in a number of different field trials in different locations, what are known as carbon eddy flux towers, for example, that are really looking not just on a day-to-day basis, but literally on a second-by-second basis, how are these various potential crops growing, and how is carbon moving relative to the production of these crops, so we can really know, what we're considering in terms of future biofuels. These are really important issues.
And I wanted to, and the second part of Joe's question had to do with, okay, we've got these Jatropha plants, and they come back every year, but do we need to be putting a lot of fertilizer or other, commercial fertilizers, let's say, on it?
You know, that's a really great question, because one of the nice things about this type of plant or growth, and really Jatropha is similar to a lot of other oil-producing plants like this. You can use palm oil and other things of the such. But what you're really only taking out of the plant is the oil. And so this oil is just your glycerol backbone and fatty acid chains, or your hydrocarbon. So it's just really the energy-dense material that you're taking out, and you're really leaving in all the other plant nutrients. So nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, those things aren't really being extracted and used for energy. So your plant, once it starts growing and uses that, you're not really harvesting that every year. So it really stays in. And anything that's in the seed, other than the oil, as Eileen mentioned earlier in the show, you can use that press cake and the remainder, the things that aren't the oil that gets extracted, and use that as a fertilizer right back on your own crops. So,
all right. So there you go. Thank you, Joe, for calling. Appreciate those good questions. Wanda in Forest Junction, we will turn to you. Hi, Wanda.
Hi again. Say, I was thinking of another advantage to growing these, I can't remember the name of that plant.
The Jatropha? Jatropha. You know,
yeah,
I'll spell it for you. It's Jatropha. And I've pronounced it different ways a couple of times, so it's my fault. Not your fault, Wanda. It's
no. I
Jatropha.
Putting a J in front of it instead of a T. Okay. Another advantage I can see planting this all over Haiti, because you have a fuel that you don't have to transport very far, so you can minus the carbon effects of transportation. basically. And another one is that it will hold rain. It will stabilize a lot of the countryside, and it will start to restore the aquifer. And we're talking fresh water for those people. And my next, just a little comment is you can cook with a Fresnel lens and have no carbon emissions.
Good to know. That's exactly right, Rhonda. That's what we're striving for.
And her points are... Her points are very well taken, are they not? I mean, isn't she's exactly right?
We agree. Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you very much for you've succinctly pointed out some real benefits to using those plants. Thank you. And Carolyn and Madison, I'm going to turn to you. Hi, Carolyn.
Oh, hi. I just hope the center, when they measure the cost or, whole footprint of a fossil fuel, coal, let's say, that they include the end result of mining and transporting, you know, the chemicals and everything that goes into the process, and all that should be added on, because and the end result. I pick coal because you get mountaintop, you damage forests, you damage water, you damage mountaintops, and on and on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's turn to John Greenler for a comment.
Yeah, well, actually, and that really it fits well with a particular project that we're currently working on, looking at developing what we call a sustainability index, which is really trying to quantify all of the different variables that are really critical in terms of looking at different types of energy sources. So clearly, energy, where is our energy going to come from? The fact that it's renewable, the fact that, it's local is very important. But then also, looking at issues in terms of social issues are very, very important, and the economic issues as well. We need to look at all of that, all of those dimensions that make up, something being sustainable. So you're right on track. And once again, those types of studies need to be done on a case-by-case basis. So, what would be sustainable, for Haiti is going to be very, very different than what might be sustainable for us here in the upper Midwest. We really need to look at and examine each particular case, each different fuel in each different region that we're trying to serve.
And as we look at this Jatropha plant, I would expect it's probably not going to work. It may not work in other third world countries or in other places. But could other plants be used on this, Eileen?
Certainly. Just exactly like John said, it's all based on what's available and what works for that region.
So we could have, I'm trying to think of a plant. I'm just trying to think of a plant. Tyler, help me out here.
Yeah, so I mean, really the whole concept in the stove design is it's good with any plant-based oil. So you can use palm oil, canola oil. You could use any oil from your kitchen cupboard. So you can pull your olive oil out and you could build a little demonstration stove right at your home and use that. So really it's a universal solution that can be adapted for specific regions for whatever plant is appropriate for that community.
And so now you're going to be continuing with this project. You've got a pilot project coming up. Eileen, are you going to be there in Haiti, or what's going on?
So right now I'm working in Haiti, but it's through another nonprofit. So as I'm developing my connections there through my separate work, I'll be talking to people about what we're doing, and then we're always going to maintain that connection through Engineers Without Borders and the community we serve there as far as a place to start a pilot program. Once it gets in line. And we have two fantastic agronomists who are from the community who we're in constant contact with via email. And they're always really excited about the work that we're working together on.
Well, it sounds great. And I didn't have time to snap a picture to put up on my Facebook page. Do you have a picture of the stove on your cocostove.org?
Oh, yeah. Yep. We got a video of it cooking there. I think we were cooking up some dinner at the time.
Well, I want to give that that website address. It's cocostove.org, and Coco is C-O-C-O stove.org. If you want to take a look at what this stove looks like and watch them actually cooking some dinner, I hope you'll go to that website. And you'll also learn some other things about the project as well. Well, thank you, the three of you, so much for being with us today. It was a great pleasure.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks again, Larry.
John Greenler, Tyler Lark, and Eileen Chow, all involved, have been involved in this Jatrova Stove Project. And thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.